I heard on the radio that there are actually, they're rerouting planes, and they're really watching out for power grids and all kinds of stuff. So who knows what may happen today. It may be a very exciting day. It already is, because you're here. We're delighted to have Joanna Shank with us, and I've invited Amy Yoder McLaughlin, I always forget whether it's Yoder McLaughlin or McLaughlin Yoder, to introduce Joanna to us further. Amy is pastor at Germantown Mennonite Church, and it's by Amy's invitation that we have Joanna here today, and I'm so grateful that we can have her and glad you're here. Amy? Oh, and by the way, we are live broadcasting this as long as the solar flares don't hit us. And it will be online later as a recording. So if there are people you know that you say, boy, you should have been there, tell them to watch. And it will be under franconiaconference.org media.
Good morning. Don't let the Yoder fool you. I did not grow up Mennonite, which is why Joanna's book is so exciting to me. In our congregation, we're about 50-50 ethnic Mennonite and whatever you want to call it. There are no good words for these divisions, but about 50% of our congregation grew up Mennonite, and the other 50 have come to our congregation and tradition out of a real interest in what Christian discipleship means. So when Joanna's book came out, I was very excited because I think that Germantown's place in how many ethnic and non-ethnic folks we have is probably not much different from where many of you are. People are drawn to the Anabaptist values that we embody. And the thing that really struck me about this book that Joanna compiled is that we have some examples of how this circle of this idea of what it means to be Mennonite is expanding. And so this is why Germantown has invited Joanna to speak with us. So I'm really delighted that you're able to share your story this morning with Franconia and Eastern District.
So a little bit about me. I get my cords untangled. My mom grew up in Franconia Conference at Blooming Glen Mennonite Church, so she's a Herzler. So I came to Blooming Glen as a little girl from time to time, especially around Christmas. We'd usually always be there for the Christmas Eve service. But the church that I grew up in was in Ohio, not in a Mennonite area. It was a Mennonite church plant, but it wasn't a church that was made up of kind of what you were talking about, made up of ethnic Mennonites. So I didn't grow up with a Mennonite identity. And so when I came to visit my grandparents' church, came to Blooming Glen, it was this very big church where people sung out of hymnals. We didn't sing out of hymnals. And I just, it wasn't a very compelling experience for me as a young adult, to say the least. You know, that was my grandparents' type of church, and our church is very different than that. And so it's been interesting in my journey, and some of it's outlined in the book, in my bio, how I've come around, and now I'm working with Mennonite Church USA, where at one point in high school, I finished high school at Bethany Christian in Goshen, and I wrote a paper in high school for an English class that started out with a first line that said, "I'm not Mennonite," with about 10 exclamation points. And my teacher, she had some responses, she graded it, and she's like, "Actually, you should only have 3 exclamation points. You know, that's correct as far as punctuation goes." I was like, okay, you know, clearly I was trying to make this. So I might get into that a little bit later, but wanted to make a few connections here. And I'm wondering, too, and this will take a couple of minutes, but you'll hear from me or hear some about me, but I'm interested also in hearing your names, where you're at. And so I know for the folks who are watching, this will be difficult. You can't see everybody, but at least you'll be able to hear people's names. Because my hope is that this conversation is something that will continue in different forms and probably is already happening here. But as a way for you all to think, okay, who's here? Who are my conversation partners as we go from here? So why don't we start at this table and, that'd be great. Just say your name and kind of your place of work or ministry or however you want.
Great. I'm Claudia Smucker. I'm at Valley Mennonite Church.
Sandy Drescher-Lehman from Souderton Mennonite Church.
Herman Gingrich, I'm one of your grandparents' pastors at Blooming Glen.
Scott Franciscus at Covenant Community Fellowship.
Sam Claudio, Christ Fellowship Church in Allentown.
Cheryl Dirksen, and I'm principal of Quakertown Christian School.
John Gosho, Blooming Glen Church.
Conrad Schwarzentruber, principal at Crystal Dock Mennonite High School.
Noah Kolb, on the staff at Franconia Conference.
Jennifer Erickson Morales, staff at Franconia Conference.
Richard Moyer, Perky Omanville Mennonite Church.
Brent Camilleri, Deep Run East Mennonite Church.
Nathan Good, and I take care of the youth and worship at Swamp Mennonite Church.
Dawn Rank, Plains Mennonite Church.
Ben Wideman, Salford Mennonite Church.
Mike Manessis, Wellspring Church of Skipack.
Bryce Berge, representing MEDA.
Jim Oslin, one of the pastors at Blooming Glen.
Gabe Brant Miller, on staff with Franconia Mennonite Conference and a member at Springmount Mennonite Church.
Amy Yoder McLaughlin, Germantown Mennonite.
Donna Moreau, Ambler Mennonite. Samantha Leoy, I'm living at Zume House in Allentown, part of the Peace and Justice Committee for Franconia and Eastern District.
Bill Cole, Methacton Mennonite.
Ben Walter, I also live at Zume House and at Ripple in Allentown.
Bob Walden, member of West Swamp Mennonite Church, and I work with the Conference Peace and Justice Committee.
Ken Burkholder, Deep Run East Mennonite Church.
Emily Ralph, I attend Salford Mennonite and on staff at Franconia Conference.
Great. And thank you for getting all of these technical things going. Very helpful. So in 2009, I graduated from Associated Mennonite Biblical Seminary in Elkhart and came on staff with Mennonite Church USA and have been working out of the Elkhart office since then. And I should say in Elkhart, some of you might be familiar with the old Mission Board campus that's on Prairie Street, Wolf Avenue, Cleveland, and some friends and I, on a tax sale, bought two of the houses of that old campus, and one of them is now pretty much finished being renovated, and we've moved in. The other one we're still working on, so that's been kind of an experiment in co-housing and community. Some of us did Mennonite voluntary service in Elkhart, which is one of the chapters in Widening the Circle about the Jubilee House, and others came there for seminary. I also, with some friends, probably 2008, 2009, started having conversations about what if we started an organic farm with a kind of long-term focus on permaculture here in Elkhart. There are a number of organic farms in Goshen and in Elkhart County, Middlebury, but there was nothing in Elkhart or near the city, and so that's something that I've also been doing. That's called Rise Up Farm. So it's been a really important way for me to be grounded in a community and to really feel that Elkhart is my home as I've been traveling around the country and visiting with other communities. It's also helped me to be more honest about the tensions of community living, shared leadership, decision-making, and really, I think, any church at its best is an intentional community, and particularly Mennonite churches that really value collective discernment and the whole body being in conversation with each other. So it's been helpful to have Elkhart as a home base. I'm also a member at Fellowship of Hope Mennonite Church, which is in Elkhart, and in the 70s, I believe, it began, maybe even the late 60s, as an intentional community, folks that had graduated from the seminary. It's no longer a community, but that, again, has been an interesting place to think about what do community experiments look like 30 years after they officially end. Like, how do the things that kind of happen in the community, in the shared life, in the common purse, still affect the way that the church functions today. So that's also been helpful for me. So when I came on staff with Mennonite Church USA, my task was
to do something that there was a lot of interest in being done, but hadn't been done before at a denominational level. So I work with Andre Gingrich Stoner in interchurch relations. And to that point, a lot of the interchurch relations had focused around ecumenical dialogue with different denominations, also with joining Christian churches together, but hadn't really moved much beyond that, in part because Andre was only working 2 days a week. So, I mean, you can only do so much. But when I came on, then my task was to connect with intentional community groups or folks that were interested in discipleship that had heard about Mennonites or were interested in the Anabaptist tradition but didn't have any way of making those connections. Or there wasn't, within our conferences, there are different categorizations. There, at this point, isn't a, like, discipleship community categorization, or if you're an intentional community, here's how you connect with us. Although there have been intentional communities that have joined conferences in various places, and so that's not without precedent. So my role was to cultivate relationships without a book, you know, that this came about a year later, the idea of putting together Widening the Circle, but just to get to know people. And so what I will start with is a few different terms that are used to describe kind of what's happening in the church in North America, and it could be beyond, so you could go to the next slide, and then we'll just click through, there'll be a number of words. And I should also say, with Widening the Circle, it specifically looks at the United States and Canada. So there is a lot of things happening all around the world related to Anabaptism and to the Mennonite Church. This book specifically looks at the North American context. Why don't we just click? There are like 8, 7 words. If you just want, yeah, okay, there we go. Okay, so my guess is that you've probably heard some or all of these words, or you know groups or people that would be associated with different things. New monasticism, and I'll just do like a quick couple sentence interpretation of each one, and then in a little bit we'll have some discussion, and if you have anything to add or questions about how I've been defining things, let me know. So new monastic was a term that was coined by Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove and others that gathered at Duke University over 10 years ago now, as a way of trying to think about this movement that was happening of mostly young adults who were coming out of the evangelical tradition, a lot of them maybe from non-denominational churches, that were saying, we want to really embody our faith, that it isn't just about having right theology, but we want to live this out every day. And so they were generally moving to cities, they were wanting to work at peacemaking in various ways, and so they were trying to think about, well, what are we doing? And they were likening it to, well, this is similar to what the monastics were doing in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, but this is a different kind of monasticism. And there is a book that they put out called The Marks of a New Monasticism. There are 12 marks. And so that's an interesting book to engage with. And that was put together, I think, close to 10 years ago. The Emergent Church was something that was coined by Brian McLaren, and I know he's kind of been around here, and most people are familiar with him, but the idea being that we need to, in some ways, emerge from our congregational or from our denominational bounds and learn from each other. So this idea was, and I talked with Brian about this once, and he said his idea was people still remaining connected to their denominations, but finding a meeting place in the middle of saying, this is what I have to offer and this is what I have to learn, and people kind of emerging in that way. What it's become, in my perspective, is more of a cohort that now defines themselves as emergent and not really necessarily tied to denominations anymore. And so as I've interfaced with them at conferences in different places, I found that there wasn't a whole lot of interest in me as someone who is a denominational staff person, because they've kind of, they're, you know, post-denomination now or something like that. So that was interesting to engage with. I wasn't sure what I would find, but that's been my experience. The Catholic Worker tradition, begun by Peter Marin and Dorothy Day, is mostly located in urban places, in cities around this country, and providing hospitality to people living in poverty. Their original idea was to always have a farming community and an urban community that were working together. That hasn't happened in a lot of places. But the way that they walk alongside people in poverty isn't necessarily to get them on the right track into wage-earning society, but as Catholic anarchists, which of course seems like an oxymoron, they have a lot of critiques of the status quo of capitalism, of the way that our country runs. So they've been criticized for not really, of being enablers, maybe. I know some friends of mine in Los Angeles had a campaign a few years ago at the Los Angeles Catholic Worker to get shopping carts for all of the homeless people so that they had a place to store their stuff. Something that I don't think about because I have lots of places to store my stuff, but they were saying these people need to at least have some place where they can keep their things and take their things with them. But they got a lot of kickback about that because they were just enabling homeless people. So it's an interesting group. Christian anarchists would, of course, be connected to Catholic Worker. There's a website that and a network that I've been connected to, and Samantha and others with within the Mennonite Church called Jesus Radicals, and you can find it at jesusradicals.com. It was started by Mennonites in New York City post 9/11, just in the year after that, wanting to have a conversation about Christianity and anarchism, and not anarchism in terms of like violent chaos, burn everything down kind of anarchism, but seeing Jesus as modeling that kind of an approach where anarchism, meaning against power over. And so what Jesus came to say was, we're not having this power over anymore. There's no longer Greek nor Jew, male nor female. And so they're trying to think about what does it mean for us as followers of Jesus to really take that seriously. And by and large, really all of the Christian anarchists I know, or a vast majority of them, are pacifists, which again might be surprising, but that's the case. They claim pacifism. Neo-Anabaptists, something that I came across in seminary as a way of describing, and it could be similar to what Stuart Murray was doing with the Naked Anabaptist, and I know he's going to be around here, or was doing a tour, yeah. But this idea of Anabaptism, like in the UK, people being Baptist Anabaptists, or Episcopal, maybe not Episcopal there, but adding Anabaptist as a way of describing the kind of Christian that they are, but still retaining whatever tradition they've come from. And of course, with Stuart Murray, he's trying to distill what are the most basic beliefs of those who are a part of the Anabaptist tradition. And what I've heard some people say about the title Naked Anabaptist is that it's very clever, but impossible, because Anabaptism has always been closed within a cultural setting. So I find that to be an interesting discussion. house churches, these are happening in lots of different places, of course. One way that they really took off was as mega churches were realizing this is a fairly impersonal thing to have thousands of people get together on Sunday morning. We need a more community-oriented focus, and so people started meeting in house churches to maintain that kind of a community connection. And then discipleship community is the last one, and that's a term that I most often use to describe the kind of groups that I'm connecting with. See them as discipleship communities. And so along with a few others, I came up with a definition, which is the next slide, and I'll just read each line and then we'll go to the next one. So discipleship is rooted in the biblical call to follow Jesus as expressed in solidarity with the poor, creative peacemaking, the inclusion of the excluded, and the formation of alternative communities. So this is how we're describing what discipleship is. And so then in terms of the communities, they're committed to the journey of transformation through this discipleship, generally work for renewal from the margins, and engage ecumenically with other like-minded groups. And so what I found as I was traveling around the country is that that there's a whole network of these communities that are related to each other in various ways. And what I thought was, as I first went out, you know, I'm meeting all of these people, and it just seems like, you know, the country is so big and there are all these things happening. But what I found after a year is that, like, everybody's maybe, like, one person removed from someone else. You know, in a similar way that, you know, with Mennonite connections, you can find people, whether you're related to them or not, that you know somebody who knows somebody, which is the same within the discipleship community circle. And so certain mentors of mine, Ted Myers and Elaine Enns, who I'll say a little bit more about later, they really encouraged me to think about this in a long perspective, that as I'm cultivating these relationships and both helping people get connected to the Mennonite church and connected to each other, that even if maybe I have disagreements or frustrations or concerns about certain communities, that it's more important to be pastoral than to be prophetic in a lot of cases, to see these as, these are, that we're in this for the long haul together. And I think as the Mennonite church, hopefully this is our view as well, we're in this for the long haul, so how can we function together in pastoral ways? And so that's what I found as I was visiting with communities, is that it's already an established network in some ways, and yet there's still this interest in connecting with the Mennonite church and with the Anabaptist tradition. So what does it look like? So I think what I will do is I'm going to share a little bit from one of the chapters in Widening the Circle. This is a chapter written by a guy named Seth McCoy. I'm going to go back then and share a bit more of an overview of the book. But in his chapter, he talks about his journey from what we termed it mega church to Mennonite. And some of you are probably familiar with Greg Boyd, who's at Woodland Hills. He's in Minnesota. And the last mega church that Seth was a youth pastor at was Greg Boyd's church. And so Greg, of course, is someone who has a strong affinity for Anabaptism and relationships with many Mennonites. And so he was preaching Jesus in an Anabaptist way, and Seth felt like, we can't do this in a mega church. And so he and others decided to start an intentional community. But he talks about what it was that drew them to the Anabaptist tradition. And so I'll read just a few excerpts here. So he says, so the question he raises, why does Third Way, that's the name of the community, want to be a part of Mennonite Church USA? He says, Mennonite theology has been foundational as we center our life together, seeking peace, community, simplicity, and reconciliation. They're all actions theologically grounded in the Mennonite tradition. As we try to take seriously our citizenship in the kingdom of God, we are inspired by the Mennonite story of resistance and community. And he talks then later about the draw in culture to this story. He says, a good segment of younger folks these days have realized that progress can be a myth and that the American dream is less than fulfilling. The megachurch movement has been about that began about 30 years ago is bearing unappetizing fruit. Clearly, we cannot inhabit the planet the way we have been for the last 50 years. We can also not allow multinational corporations to shape our lives with their marketing and gadgets. It's sad to say, but when the church began adopting practices of corporations and reducing the gospel to its most marketable size, we lost our mystery, our wonder, and our imagination. Mennonite theology affirms that we can experience and share the kingdom here and now. The life of the Spirit invites us again into the story of wonder and mystery. When our society says peacemaking, they mean the absence of conflict. When we say peacemaking, we mean shalom, the harmony of all creation restored through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So that's one brief example of the attraction of these communities to the Mennonite tradition. And so if we go to the next slide, there's a couple pictures that you might recognize. So this is a huge draw for people in discipleship communities because they realize we're not the first people to do this. There are folks for a couple hundred years, and if they look back over all of church history, you'll find examples, of course, but to say there's a group of Christians that really believe we're called to love our enemies and that our faith is worth dying for. And that's compelling in this culture like Seth is talking about that's become in some ways more controlled by corporations than by the good news of Jesus. So I think that's one thing that we offer. And part of what I've challenged the Mennonite, part of the challenge that I bring to the Mennonite church as I'm having these conversations is we don't just reference our radical history as, you know, a merit badge, but we talk about the complicated parts of our history. We talk about the really difficult times and the times when we weren't really embodying what the radical Reformation was about. And I think for groups that are trying to do this, I mean, sooner or later, you hit up against the reality that it's really hard. And so I think as the Mennonite Church, when we can own our tradition in a really full way, that's powerful for groups that are doing this, that we're naming both the strengths that we carry and the weaknesses, and even the things that we struggle with now as the church. I think that's a really important part of our testimony to not shy away from that. And so on the next slide, we have from the introduction with Ted Myers and Elaine Enns, and so thank you, Emily. Just one more. They talk about disillusionment, disestablishment, and decentering being kind of in the North American Christian milieu right now, that this is what people are experiencing. So I'm going to read just a little bit to explain what they're getting at, and then I'm interested to hear both related to these descriptors, but also to anything else that I've shared up to this point, if that's resonated with the kind of communities that are sprouting up and growing around here, if it's representative of how those in establishment Mennonite churches have been seeking relationship with those who aren't a part of established or traditional Mennonite churches. So I'm interested to hear, does this resonate? Have you had other experiences? So Chet and Elaine say, related to disillusionment, through the Reagan-Bush eras, the Christian right became a formidable sociological and political force and arguably the most dominant religious stratum in the United States, its backbone formed by white suburban evangelical megachurches. But this edifice is now crumbling due to a variety of factors, including hyper-politicization, internal contradictions, and relatively shallow theological moorings. Thousands of young people from this world who have come of age under the shadow of global warming, resource wars, and deadening consumerism are experiencing deep alienation from both their dysfunctional churches and society. Many are seeking more authentic, holistic, and traditioned models of faith and practice, and significant numbers are engaging Anabaptism for this reason. That's the disillusionment that they see. Disestablishment, they talk about the shrinking of Protestant denominations and an interest in being drawn to discipleship, gospel nonviolence, and learning how to become truly post-Christendom churches, both at the level of formal ecumenical conversation and even more widely at the grassroots. Mennonites have become the subject of genuine interest because of the ways that we've been committed to this kind of disestablishment, although we are very established in some ways throughout our history. And decentering. They say all North American denominations, including Mennonites, are experiencing the impact of changing demographics, which are steadily eroding European majorities. And they go on to say that in these matters, Mennonites have as much to learn as to offer other traditions that are experiencing this. So disillusionment, establishment, and decentering. And so then the last point, thank you, Emily, is like I said, how does this relate to your experience and context? So that's me kind of putting a lot out there and then asking a very vague question. So I realize maybe that's hard to latch on to. But I wonder, in Eastern District, in Franconia, does this resonate? Has the experience been different? Are there discipleship communities here? Are our churches discipleship communities? And we have a... And if you could say your name, too, that'd be great.
Sam Claudio from Christ Fellowship. As far as the one that stood out to me was the decentering, because in our congregation, you won't find any of the white middle class individuals. It's all very ethnic, very diverse. So in that way, the decentering is very prevalent to our context.
And I'm wondering then, what does that mean then?
It means having Bible studies bilingually. It means very long Bible studies, because after you say something in English, you've got to repeat it in Spanish, or after you say something in Spanish, you've got to repeat it in English. It means having individuals with a background in other denominations, other denominations such as Pentecostal and Catholic, and coming together and really trying to, I guess, understand each other in mm-hmm. that way.
Claudia Smucker, Valley Mennonite. One of the things that I really appreciated that you said was about. And I might mangle this, so correct it, but you talked about peace and how peace is not just the absence of war. Mm-hmm. So I'm probably reinterpreting you, but that it's a shalom, peace and harmony that Jesus brings us. And one of the tensions in my congregation is this conversation. We have very passionate peace and justice people. And we have people who are not that way, who maybe are at the other extreme and wonder why. And this whole idea of, and we have a very good discipleship community. We have a community garden, and we have a community center and a preschool. But I think this whole idea of the shalom can bring us together in that point, that the centering is on Christ and what Christ brings us. And does that make
Mm-hmm. So what does that, or what can that look like?
Well,
and you described mm-hmm. some of those things.
I
already.
Think to focus. I mean, I definitely want to promote the absence of war, mm-hmm. but also that's not just what peace means. Mm-hmm. That there is this, that the discipleship that we're already doing is also helping to provide this shalom. And I don't know, you just gave me like this little mm-hmm. I think,
like, in your immediate context.
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. that it's there. We just need to mm-hmm. to name it and recognize it, and that it doesn't have to be an either or.
Yeah. Mhm. Yeah, right on.
Amy Yoder McLaughlin from Germantown. These themes of disillusionment, disestablishment, and decentering are things that I see a lot in the urban context, particularly among young Mennonite kids who have graduated from Mennonite colleges and like come to the city. And I don't know if they're trying to hide from the church or if they don't have any interest in it, but I hear these themes, and it's interesting that that's even coming out of the Mennonite tradition. I think you spoke of that more as coming out of the evangelical mm-hmm. tradition. But we have a lot of that in our own young people that have come up in the church and hear the hypocrisy of our own tradition. And so the challenge for our congregation lately is how do we tap into those people and give them a space to be disgusted with the church, in the church. And I'm interested in hearing from you, Joanna, how you've seen congregations try to work with that.
Well, I think in my own experience, it goes back to that posture of owning our entire history. And I wonder, I mean, I live in Elkhart. Elkhart and Goshen are kind of historic Mennonite centers, and Franconia Conference, Eastern District, I mean, these conferences have been around for a long time. In terms of establishment, if we have Mennonite establishment, it's in these places. And so, I mean, and we do. I mean, I work, I'm a Mennonite bureaucrat, right? So I wonder, what does it look like for us to own that whole history? And to talk about why certain things happened when they did, or, you know, why we organized ourselves in the way that we organized ourselves, you know, and how did we deal with money, and how is that, you know, in keeping with our Mennonite values, or how is it not? And, I mean, I think we could have that conversation along a lot of lines, but what gives me the most hope as I'm working within the denomination is that I can sit down with my colleagues and really talk about how complicated things are and not try to see it as, here's our complicated aberration over here, and here's our complicated aberration here and here, and how do we fix it? But instead to say, this is where we are, you know, and this is a part of what it means to seek shalom, is to really get at the roots of things, you know, and not just to be protesting this or that there, but to say, we need to do this work within our own communities. And again, I'm speaking within generalization, so I'll make it very specific. At Fellowship of Hope, which was an intentional community, like I said, that ceased to be an intentional community in the 80s, there was a lot of pain with that community breaking apart. It had been a common purse, so everyone shared their money, and so when it fell apart, I mean, that's always complicated. And it was complicated for a lot of other reasons, power dynamics, who got to make the decisions, who just had to do all of the background work and labor. But what's been most encouraging to me is when at Fellowship of Hope, we can talk about what was really good about that common life experience, and what was really difficult, and why did people leave, and why has it been hard to really talk through some of those issues. So that's been an example to me, and not everyone is necessarily interested in doing that, but it's helped me to grow and think about my own formation when I can talk with people about how incredibly messy and complicated it was, and how that continues to have an effect, but how it doesn't need to control, you know, the church going into the future. So I think just being able to name these things and letting things be complicated.
I was intrigued as our partnership between Franconia Conference and the Anabaptist Network in the United Kingdom has become established and grown. Stuart Murray Williams said his interest in the partnership was to come alongside a group who has been trying to embody Anabaptist principles and theology for many years. And no, he's not interested in our coverings and our, you know, all the clutter, but he knows that there's a core, a center that is very that has held true, and that's the piece that he was very interested in them connecting to us about.
Well, we'll continue to have conversations throughout, but there's another story that I want to share, and I guess the next slide runs through. This is, you know, the joys and the frustrations of PowerPoint. When I want to, like, rearrange things in the moment, it's hard to do. So these are some of the, and you can scroll down through them. I'll give it a second so that you can read them, and then I'll, thank you so much, Emily. So these are some of the themes that are engaged, and each of the chapters is written by a different individual. I didn't write the chapters, and there are two that I did interviews for, but the others are all written in first person, and people are wrestling with these things within the context of their own story, of their community, of their church. Some people grew up in the Mennonite church and have remained a part of it. Others came to the Mennonite church and joined, and some grew up in the Mennonite church and kind of moved away, and others joined and eventually left. And so what I wanted to do was to get at these conversations from a lot of different angles, and to also have people write in a way that is, Amy and I were talking about this on the way over, kind of powerfully humble, that no one in the book is saying, we've got it figured out, here's the game plan, folks, you know, just come and be like us. But people are saying, these have been our joyful experiences. These have been times when we really were doing well what we felt God was calling us to do. And these are the times that we fell short, quite frankly, or this is when we decided we weren't going to continue doing a certain program or living in a certain neighborhood or being a community in a certain way. And I mean, that kind of gets at this last one here, life cycles of community, birth, death, and rebirth. And rebirth could also be resurrection. But that's the way that they're engaging these stories, both with a strong, both with a deep respect for the Anabaptist tradition and for the Mennonite church and for the way that it has nurtured them, and also with serious questions for how we continue to be church together. and so you'll find that in every chapter. And of course, I mean, it's covering a number of different topics, but in every chapter, that kind of a wrestling with themselves, with their own growth and transformation, with their communities, with the broader church. Because what I found up until this book coming out was that a lot of the conversation that was happening between discipleship communities and the Mennonite church would be along the lines of Shane Claiborne coming to a Mennonite conference, giving us all a nice pat on the back for our radical history, you know, like, oh, cool, famous people like us, you know, and then, you know, kind of we're going on our merry way. And I think that there is so much that is valuable and really important within the Mennonite tradition, but I think it also needs to be coupled with a continued challenge that are we really living this out? And what does it look like for us to live this out? And so my hope is that with this book and in my work, that we see these as mutually transformative relationships, where as a denomination, as established churches, we have a lot of resource, a lot of history, a lot of a lot that we can share. And these communities can really benefit from that. For example, the Jesus Radicals gathering, which I told you about, Christianity and Anarchism in Conversation, the last 2 years has been hosted at a Mennonite Church USA congregation. It was hosted at Portland in 2010, Portland Mennonite, and at Faith Mennonite in Minneapolis in 2011. And that is, I think, a huge testimony to these groups of mostly young adults who have felt really kind of disowned from their church traditions, and so they go to this Christian anarchist conference, and they're in a Mennonite church. The sign on the outside says, you know, this is Mennonite church. And maybe, you know, they continue to explore what that means, and maybe they don't. But that's a really, I think, powerful sign of hospitality from our tradition. And that's not saying, you know, we totally understand and are in agreement with every point of however you articulate anarchism. You know, that's not what's being said, but it's being said, we want to create a space for you to continue to seek discipleship And so that would be one example. I want to now, so if we go to the next slide, you'll see a picture of, thank you, Emily, of Seth, who I just shared from his chapter. But I want to share on the next slide from Andrea Ferrick's chapter. And Andrea's story is a little bit closer to home here. So I'll read from the first section. This Andrea currently lives in Camden, New Jersey, and she does urban gardening and farming there, a lot of really creative stuff, reclaiming, and she talks in her chapter about reclaiming like the garbage of industrialization for resurrection purposes. And her chapter is called Widening the Communion Circle, Environmental Justice in Camden, New Jersey. This is how Andrea starts her chapter. My journey towards the Peace Church began in a war zone on the other side of the world. Although my last name is German, I'm not an ethnic Mennonite. I grew up in the Mennonite Church with my family. I attended Locust Grove Mennonite School in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and walked to church on Sundays. My father was drafted out of high school in 1965 straight into the Armored Cavalry of the United States Army. He fought in the American War in Vietnam, and amidst the violence on the land and people, he found peace. As he rode in his armored tank surrounded by a conclave of armed and marching soldiers, my father remembers a group of Buddhist monks that came walking for peace into a small village his brigade was occupying. He saw about a dozen monks wearing only saffron tunics, walking for peace with no food, no weapons, only prayer. My dad committed himself to finding a group of Christians that carried out their faith commitments in the same way, following Christ in simplicity, peace, and community. This war brought my family to the Mennonite Church and shaped a great journey of justice for me. The Mennonite Church taught me to pursue justice. In the purest sense, justice means changing the oppressive systems that are in place to new systems that allow us to fully love each other. Justice was a central theme for me while attending the Mennonite Church. I learned about traditions of nonviolence, how to fiercely love the land, and about the great work of the Mennonite Central Committee. Yet even with these embodied understandings of justice, the hierarchy of the church loved their accomplishments more than seeking equal partnership with those they helped. After 5 years of church attendance, we were still being introduced to visiting clergy and outsiders as the Ferrick family from the city that came to know Christ through the urban outreach ministries of the church. We realized that we were never going to be full members. The church leadership chose to remember what they gave us rather than recognizing our vital contributions to the community. Perhaps this was done to relieve a guilty conscience or to make a show of power. For these reasons, my family left the Mennonite Church. So that's how she begins, and she talks later on in her chapter about continuing to retain that formation and Mennonite identity, and so it's not something that she's just cast aside. But I think that's a really important story, especially for those of us who live in places with more established Mennonite churches, that it's easier for us to see, look at all this that we have and that we can give and all of the people that we're sending around the world, and not recognizing the gifts that we're being given by the people in our communities, in our neighborhoods, that maybe haven't come from the same background, don't have the same kind of resources. But like you were saying, Sam, that what it can look like when we allow ourselves to be decentered. That maybe it is uncomfortable for a number of folks who are a part of your church, but yet that's a journey that they've chosen to go on, and maybe other people are uncomfortable for other ways. But I think that kind of decentering can be really generative. So, So why don't we go to the next slide? This, if you were at convention, I shared this briefly at convention, my very sophisticated diagram of movements and institutions and relationship. And the idea here being that the Spirit is moving from the mission of God, from Missio Dei, and then along the way, the movements of the Spirit become institutions like the Mennonite Church, for example, birthed out of the Radical Reformation, and out of the Mennonite Church continue to come movements of different kinds. And there would be, I mean, we could think about the Civil Rights Movement along these lines, a lot of things where we see that movements birth institutions and institutions birth movements, and this isn't a opposite end of the spectrum kind of relationship, but it's very much an interrelated, symbiotic relationship between movements and institutions. And so that's often, whether I'm talking with people in the Mennonite Church in establishment roles or people in the movement to say, we really need each other. This can be really generative and creative. And so it doesn't end up being the experience that Andrea Farrick and her family has, because we see we need these things together, really engaging, and in some ways, Amy, related to your question, saying, let's look at the difficult stuff. Like, let's just name it and not try to resolve it and put it in a package, but just say it's there, and we need each other to stay on this road of discernment and discipleship. So, again, I'll stop and see, how does this resonate? Where is this happening? Where could this be happening? I mean, you talked some, Gay, about the partnership in the UK and with Stuart Murray, and I think that is one example of this kind of a relationship. But what does that look like here? What could that look like here?
Well, at Ripple, Ben Walter, Ripple, and at Ripple we have some large churches supporting us some, and we're actually just starting, you know, kind of brainstorming and thinking about ways that we can partner with, engage, have relationships with more established Mennonite churches. So we're kind of just what you're saying, just it's kind of we're in the beginning stages of trying to really move forward with that. I'm not sure what it's going to look like exactly, I mean, but yeah, it sounds like what you're saying.
And there's been interest on both sides of really saying what could happen here, or have you mostly been initiating?
No, there's interest. I mean, there's definitely interest. Like, you know, some Thomas had our lead pastor has had people come to him and be like, you know, we want to be a Ripple, you know, or can we like take part in Ripple, or do you have like a Ripple curriculum that shows us how to be a Ripple, you know? And we're kind of like, okay, but. You know, so, I mean, there's definitely interest, but, I mean, I think there has to be, you know, some communication there and some deepening of understanding, and you know, we have to be wary of trying to, you know, falling temptation to trying to package it, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, but, yeah.
Andy Drescher Lehman from Souderton Mennonite Church. What it looks like at our church is, knowing that we're one of the larger churches of the conference, we also are acknowledging a lot of different streams of spirituality and different ways of living out our discipleship. And so what we've decided is that anybody that has a vision for a ministry in the church or outside the church and has a core team of four people that are passionate about it and willing to lead it, that we will back as long as that movement keeps going. So we've watched different ministries come and go. Some are sticking and some are just experiments, which risk is one of our core values as well. So that's okay with us if it doesn't work out. But that's just exciting to watch all kinds of things that, as a pastoral team, we don't have the energy to do all of these things. We just are trying to keep up with all the people who have passions in our congregation. And that's one exciting way that I'm watching institutions and movements work together. And that's one of the ways that I can stay part of an institutional church.
Mm-hmm. I'm Nathan Good from Swamp. And I guess just a question that I have is, how
in all of these movements, do you see us remaining grounded in the Missio Dei? I guess a concern that I have is sometimes in things like the Radical Reformation and Radical Reformations that are even happening now, sometimes it becomes Reformation for the sake of Reformation rather than actually us seeking the mission of God. So how have you seen some intentional communities doing that? And also, I think for us to think of as churches, whether it's programs that we're pursuing or whether it's radical things that there is no program label for, how do we bring that back to the Missio Dei rather than having a program for the sake of a program or a non-program for the sake of a non-program?
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear how anyone in this room would answer that, because I think we're all qualified to give responses. So I'll start with something, but please, if anyone else has something to add, do. Well, I think that part of it is seeing what's happening in the present as informed by everything that's come before it. And so often, like, reformation for the sake of reformation, or like being radical, or being oppositional just for the sake of being oppositional. I mean, hopefully we all go through a phase of differentiation in our life where we're like needing to like push up against something, but if that is our orientation for always, then that's not healthy. So, and I think that, and I don't think I'm saying anything groundbreaking here, but I think that that's also, when we think about what's happening in our churches or in these communities, are we just constantly reacting to wherever we came from, or are we seeing that as a part of how we've been shaped, both recognizing the strengths and the weaknesses of it? So I think, that would be one layer of response. But I think another, too, is being serious about the Bible, like doing Bible study and really both thinking about what was the context in which this text was put together and what is our context now. And so someone like Ched Myers, I mean, if you do a Bible study with Ched Myers, it's like, it's deep. and there are lots of really great Bible teachers, but I think looking at it from the context in which it came and looking at it deeply within our context is what we need to be doing. That, and I think that there are places for all different kinds of interactions with the Bible, like Lectio Divina and lots of different forms, but I think we really need to continue to take the Bible seriously, and not in the sense of I can't disagree or I can't see the Bible as a living document, but so maybe what I'm saying is, and I've been talking about this with some folks in community recently, is what would like Mennonite Midrash look like? This conversation with the text. I mean, isn't that in some ways in keeping with our tradition? I mean, this discernment within community, discernment with the text. I don't know. Maybe I'll think about that some more. But those are some initial responses. I don't know what other responses do people have to that question. And you don't have to be a pastor to respond.
I guess part of what I start thinking, I'm Samantha Leoy, part of what I start thinking about when I hear you say that is, how do we, what I hear underneath your question, I guess, is how are we formed by the mission of God so that whatever we're doing, whatever action we take, comes out of that rather than, wait, does this program or does non-program fit with the mission of God? Like, we're sort of asking that question too late, you know, that. And I guess when I think about our household and how slowly it comes into being, this intentional community thing, you know, we're still fixing up rooms. We're in this sort of contemplation stage, you know, of what could happen, what is God already doing in the city, what are the relationships we already have. You know, it is a certain, I forget who said this, but like exegeting your neighborhood or, you know, your town. And so that whatever your action is really rooted in that. I think that's maybe a place for at least European-descended Mennonites to learn about waiting, or like a little bit more patient, because we're very much people of action, it seems like, as a tradition. It's a very action-oriented tradition. And to sort of say, okay, before we, I mean, we know that there are lots of good things we can do. What is God asking us to do? What is God calling? You know, and it's easy to say, but I guess I've seen the need for that kind of patience, because we are like, we're not doing anything. We're not helping our neighbors. We don't, you know, but we're building relationships and we're getting our place ready for people to come. And that's a long, slow, and like very mundane process.
Other responses, questions?
Just to add to that, I'm Bob Walden, just to add to what Samantha said, I think maybe a first step for some of us is just to get out and see our neighbors, to see the people who are homeless, to see the people who are in prison, to see the people who have been left out, who are often not part of our congregations, who are often not part of the mainstream of society. Once we begin to see those people who are central to Jesus' concern, then we can begin to see where God is at work and where we need to be at work.
Well, I can go on to the, there's one more story that I'm interested in sharing. And I should also say, as you can see, I have some books here. They're $15 a piece, and you can pay with different methods, check, credit card, cash, so, and I'll be around afterwards if you're interested in that. There also is a free downloadable study guide for the book if you were wanting to go through it with a group or at church, at a school, anything like that. And I have a few of those available if you want to skim through what the study guide looks like. But I want to end with a story from Selena Varela, who is at Reba Place Fellowship. And so we'll go through, and again, I'm improvising as I go. This is a great chapter, really important to engage with Vincent Harding. I won't go into that right now. And then we kind of are talking about these questions. And these, I would leave you with these questions as well. And if we have time, maybe we'll come back to it. I mean, we've been already responding to them. But Selena Varela, she is at Reba Place Fellowship now in Evanston, which is one of the oldest intentional communities in the United States. And I think that with her story, she embodies this kind of wrestling with tradition, with a community. And so what you'll find in the Reba Place chapter, which is chapter 3, I think, is an outline of the history of Reba Place. And Sally Schreiner-Youngquist writes that part. She's the current community leader. But what I love about how she did it is she says, we've basically been five different communities. So a lot of people look at Reba Place and are like, oh, they've got it right. They're, you know, still around because we think the best thing is to never cease to exist, which isn't necessarily always the best thing. But she says, we've been all of these different communities. And I think that's true for our congregations as well, and for other community groups, that if we really are in touch with what's happening around us, we continue to change. So Selena reflects as a newer member of the community. She says, in the summer of 2006, I traveled from hot and dry Texas to the cooler, more humid Midwest for a visit with Reba Place Fellowship. I had just completed 5 years in a Baptist seminary with a course that allowed me to travel through India. My journey through the beauty and desolation of that country reminded me of the same trek I took through my biblical studies. In seminary, I wrestled with the confusing, difficult parts of Scripture, grieved over the ugly parts of church history, and came away still inspired by the wonder of the biblical text and still believing in the power of God's Spirit to act in the midst of a community of people. So I set out to find a group of people who were living out Jesus' call to peace in a real way. I wanted to be a part of a people who were responding to the words of Jesus in what they did with their money and how they welcomed the poor. I wanted to see a church community that was living out God's desire to lift the valleys and lower the mountains and make uneven ground level. I wanted to find a group of people meeting one another's needs in a way that made the distribution even, where no one had more than another. So she is very specific about what she is looking for, and it gets even more specific. I was specifically hoping to find an intentional Christian community that was intergenerational, in existence for more than 10 years, pacifist, and practicing shared finances and resources. My searching brought me to Real Place Fellowship, and I have been a part of this community since then. My experience as a woman at the fellowship has moments of seeming ease. The Southern Baptist world had provided me with a great deal of discipleship and spiritual formation, but it left me with some timidity and uncertainty about desiring to take leadership in church life. The seminary I attended helped to undo some of the harm and led me to the beginnings of healing from negative thoughts that sprang into my mind every time I had the desire to preach. As I participate with the community here, I find that my mentors are very eager to hear about my desires to encounter and to encourage abilities they see in me. As a result, I preach at the church occasionally. I serve on the fellowship's current leadership team and was a part of the past team in 2008. Our current community leader is a woman, and she has made great effort to include a number of other women on the leadership team. The roots that settle are not so easy to dig up, though. The practices embedded by past actions make it difficult to move beyond the historical space where women were not supported in leadership. Historically, the fellowship never made a concrete decision to keep women out of leadership, but there is enough disagreement on the topic to keep the community from fully affirming the practice. A sparse number of women served on leadership, but most women were happy to serve in other ways. In 2008, when I served on the leadership team, many times I was the only woman present at meetings. I was the note taker and found it very difficult at times to know how to break into the conversation. I understood then the desire by women to serve in other ways. As a recently married person, I find it difficult to break gender roles within our household. And we intentionally try to be mindful about sharing responsibilities. This is her husband. And just a couple months ago, they had a little baby boy. And so I don't have a picture of him. But they're all part of the community. She says, whenever I find myself going into the kitchen to take over my husband's night to cook, I lament the immense hold the historical roots of patriarchy have on me. Beyond the questions I have about my participation at the fellowship as a woman, I often find myself wondering about my experience as a Latina. Recent discussions in a group started by the church around the topic of racial reconciliation encouraged me to consider my own racial identity formation. I became more aware of the reasons behind my responses to life within the Reba community, which is predominantly white. Through this work, I've realized that my difficulty to break into discussions around the leadership team circle were not only due to gender roles, but also my experience as a person of color. The fellowship is far from a perfect community. If I came because I believed it held out to me the practices embodied by the ideals in my head, I did not stay because community living proved to be flawless. I have questions about being a part of the fellowship. How do we resist war with our finances? How does the fellowship stance as property owners affect our relationship with our neighbors? How do we live in unity while holding differing opinions on topics like our acceptance of the GLBT community? While these questions may affect my decisions regarding whether or not I join the fellowship as a full member, participating in the common purse, they do not change my desire to be a part of the Reba community. I stay in Evanston because I feel compelled to be a part of this imperfect community wrought with human frailty. I continue on with this group of people because I believe that no community could possibly be free of all these difficulties. I continue to serve because it is here I have found people, both within and outside of Reba Place Fellowship, willing to work through the struggle with me. May God give us grace to continue. So those are Selena's words. So I see we're at about 5 minutes. I don't know if there's any other thoughts or reflections, but you're welcome to share them. And I always wish that we had a little bit more time because I've definitely dominated the airspace.
Scott Franciscus. Sorry, my voice doesn't work today that well. I just have a quick question or want your maybe feedback, you know, on this idea of widening the circle of entering into different streams of thoughts of who has entered into maybe Anabaptism. Mm-hmm. I read an article, I think it happened this year, I found interesting that also Rick Warren credits Anabaptism mm-hmm. for his faith and his work at Saddleback. And how does that then enter into the conversation in the sense of some of the things that talked about tend to be, I guess, on the practice side of things. One could argue Rick Warren maybe is more on a theology side of things, that sometimes his emphasis is more on right thinking or right theology and right practice. How does those two kind of maybe come together? Because that's my, actually, I guess, background entering into the stream, if you want to speak. I came from the Episcopal Church that was very interested more on maybe practice than necessarily a theology. Mm-hmm. And then I also attended what we would say would be evangelical churches that tended to be more on theology than maybe practice. Mm-hmm. And as I looked at the historical Anabaptist of, say, Menno Simons, Marpeck, and those guys, I saw a group of people that embody both. Mm-hmm. And yet I also now see an Anabaptism of today that maybe is more grounded in a Yoderite, John Howard Yoder, and this neo-Anabaptism than necessarily a historical Anabaptism. Mm-hmm. So how does that all work together?
Or how does it not work together?
In 3 minutes. Yeah,
3 minutes. Well, I think that I mean, I would be interested, a couple things came to mind. How Seth McCoy, who came out of the megachurch movement, would have a conversation with Rick Warren about these things. Because for him, to really embody what he understood to be the Anabaptist tradition in Mennonite faith, he just couldn't do it in a megachurch. So, I mean, I would be interested to hear some of his reflections on that. I would also wonder, I mean, it makes me think about the whole naked Anabaptist idea, because can Rick Warren be a naked Anabaptist? You know, or does the trappings of Saddleback have some bearing on Anabaptist identity? Like, is that some of the clothing that he's, I mean, I think it is the clothing that he's wearing, is this church that he's created, and then what does that say about the ability to hold Anabaptist belief without certain kinds of Anabaptist practice? And again, that's a long conversation. And I know that people across the Mennonite Church have been responding in various ways to Rick Warren saying that everything, all of the theology or something that Saddleback you stole from the Anabaptists. I mean, some people, again, are like, wow, that's really cool. You know, someone who's engaging our tradition, and, you know, and trying to take it seriously in different ways, and other people saying that really is inconsistent with who we say we are as Mennonites and Anabaptists. So, I mean, I think that, right, and I mean, in that way,
so you actually have some possessive words here. Mm-hmm. And agree in that dialogue with what he had, you know, at the conference he had, and saying that some of the pushback is this: well, he can't own our tradition, mm-hmm. Which then seems to be in contrast to what our tradition says it is.
Right.
So how do we then maybe relate to those that maybe on a theology we don't, or even maybe an ideology, we don't actually agree. Because that was another question I would have, is how much of some of this stuff is born out of an ideology than necessarily theology?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the question of possession of the tradition is a really important one, like, and how we think about that. And I mean, you're getting at a lot of other stuff. Maybe we can follow up on. But I think that, you know, whether we're talking about Rick Warren or others, we need to think about is how are we embodying this, and how do we identify with it? Is it because my last name is Shank that I get to be a Mennonite gatekeeper? You know, is it because I work for the Mennonite Church, or because, you know, so-and-so is a pastor or a Mennonite theologian or historian? So, yeah, I think there's a lot there that we need to continue to wrestle with. Yeah, no quick 3-minute answers. But, yeah.
Well, Joanna, thank you so much for being with us today and helping us sense the tip of the iceberg of this huge topic. But I really appreciate your work on our behalf through the Mennonite Church USA. And as a young woman leader in the church, we bless you in your work. Thank you so much for being here today. I invite you to rise, and Sandy Drescher-Lehman is going to send us with a benediction.
Thank you, God, for the blessing that you've given us today by remembering our history and also encouraging and supporting and affirming the new movements that you're showing us. I ask a further blessing from you to be able to be open to seeing where you are moving and to be able to embrace all that comes our way in this one wild and wonderful life.